Imagine for a second, right, that you are playing a game of musical chairs.
Okay, yeah. The classic party game.
Exactly. And the rules are usually pretty simple. The music plays, you know, everyone walks in a circle, and then the music stops, and you just scramble to find a seat.
Right, any seat will do.
Yeah, it doesn't matter which seat. It's chaotic, it's reactive, and it's mostly just about not being the one left standing when the silence hits.
Which is pretty much how we historically viewed executive job hopping, right?
Yes, exactly. But imagine if, right in the middle of the game, the music stops, and instead of just grabbing a chair, the people who own the chairs suddenly demand that you prove you know how to build one from scratch.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. Like, you have to explain the tensile strength of the wood, the cost of the upholstery, and, you know, exactly what you would do if one of the legs snapped completely off while you were sitting on it.
I mean, that completely shifts the dynamic from a game of simple survival to a high-stakes interrogation of your fundamental mechanics. You are no longer just looking for a place to sit. You're being audited on your ability to maintain the structural integrity of the entire room.
And that is exactly what we are exploring today on this deep dive. We're looking at a massive, like, sweeping wave of corporate transitions that is reshaping the Australian business landscape right now across 2025 and 2026.
Yeah, and we should clarify, this isn't just an abstract theory.
No, not at all. We are grounding this deep dive in an extensive analysis from Byron Thomas Recruitment. It was authored by Peter Morgan in May 2026.
Right, and the data completely dissects Australia's latest C-suite moves. And to be clear on the scale here for you listening, we aren't talking about scrappy little startups trying to find product market fit in a garage.
Yeah, definitely not.
We are looking at major, listed, nationally significant organizations, like businesses well beyond the $500 million threshold.
Which is huge.
It is. These are places where the decisions made in the boardroom ripple out to affect national supply chains, millions of consumers, and, you know, entire ecosystems of jobs.
The scale is really what makes the underlying patterns so critical to understand. The mission of our deep dive today isn't to simply read a roster of who moved to which corner office.
Right, because that's just raw data.
Exactly. And frankly, it's not very useful on its own. The objective is to decode the mechanisms behind these moves. Like, why did a specific board choose a highly specific profile of a human being at this exact moment in time?
Yeah, and what do these multi-billion dollar choices signal about the absolute cutting edge of executive hiring, leadership, and how corporate strategy is actually executed on the ground?
Right. We are hunting for the hidden architecture of these decisions. So let's get our boots dirty and start with the absolute bedrock of the Australian economy, which is the massive capital-intensive world of mining, resources, and energy.
Oh, absolutely. The engine room of the economy.
Yeah. We're talking about an environment where the stakes are as physical as it gets. You have massive autonomous machinery, incredibly complex global supply chains, and, you know, capital investments that span decades.
And when you look at the executive shifts happening in this space, there is a glaring thematic shift.
What kind of shift?
Well, the era of the celebrity CEO-like, the charismatic, purely public-facing visionary who spends most of their time giving keynote speeches and schmoozing at Davos, that era is effectively over in the resources sector.
The data really backs that up. Let's look at BHP, for example. Brandon Craig is stepping up to take over as CEO and a director from July 1st, 2026, succeeding Mike Henry.
Right.
Now, when you look at Craig's background, it is steeped in deep internal operational credibility. He previously led BHP's America's growth strategy, but perhaps more importantly, he ran Western Australia Iron Ore.
Let's pause there and actually unpack what running Western Australia Iron Ore means.
Yes, please do.
Because operational credibility can sound like a corporate buzzword, right? But WA Iron Ore is not just a business unit. It is a sprawling sovereign state level logistical empire.
Sovereign state level. That's massive.
Yeah. It really is. We are talking about multiple massive mining hubs connected by thousands of kilometers of privately owned rail networks, terminating at dedicated port facilities that load colossal bulk carrier ships. It is an intricate 24/7 machine.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second.
Yeah.
If I am running that machine, what am I actually doing day to day that prepares me to be the CEO of the entire BHP group?
Yeah.
Because It sounds to me like I'm just a really high-level traffic cop.
It goes so much deeper than traffic management, I promise you. The friction in a system like that is measured in the tens of millions of dollars per hour.
Millions per hour?
Yes. If a massive piece of autonomous drilling equipment fails, or, you know, a cyclone shuts down Port Hedland, or even a localized labor dispute slows down the rail network, the entire global supply chain feels it.
Wow. Okay.
So Brandon Craig didn't just sit in a downtown office looking at a dashboard. He had to intimately understand the physical realities of moving millions of tons of dirt from the Pilbara to a steel mill in Asia safely and profitably.
Despite fluctuating iron ore prices and, like, unpredictable weather.
Exactly.
I see. So when the BHP board is looking for their next CEO, they aren't looking for someone to paint a beautiful picture of the future. They're looking at Brandon Craig and saying, this guy knows exactly what the engine sounds like when a rod is about to be thrown.
Yes, he knows the physical limits of the machine. They are overwhelmingly choosing deep, hands-on operational experience. And we see this mirrored perfectly at Woodside Energy with the appointment of Liz Westcott.
Right, Liz Westcott. She was officially appointed CEO and managing director in March 2026.
But only after serving as the acting CEO.
Yeah, that acting CEO period is fascinating to me. It's like a high-stakes audition.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the board actually testing during that time? Like, why not just do a massive global search and bring in a heavy hitter from outside?
Because energy project delivery, especially right now, requires an almost pathological level of discipline. When Woodside put her in the acting CEO role, they were creating a controlled environment to observe her decision-making under live fire.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Think about the energy sector right now. You have incredibly sensitive investment points, transitioning grids, massive regulatory pressure, and, you know, the sheer cost of delivering liquefied natural gas projects.
Right, those are multi-billion dollar projects.
Exactly. A board doesn't want to guess how an external candidate might handle a sudden 20% cost blowout on a key infrastructure project. They want to watch Liz Westcott handle it in real time.
It's the ultimate prove-it scenario. They want to see if she can maintain the capital discipline when the pressure is on, rather than just, like, talking about discipline in a cushy interview room.
And she clearly proved she could. The board's preference for disciplined energy project delivery over a flashy external hire is a clear signal to the market. Execution is the only thing that matters right now.
Which brings us to the third example in this sector, Parenti. Dr. Vanessa Torres becomes managing director and CEO from June 2026. And the mandate there leans incredibly heavily into technical operating experience, safety, and managing complex global teams. Now, Parenti is a mining services company, which is slightly different from a pure miner like BHP, right?
That is a crucial distinction, yes. A mining services company is essentially the contractor that goes in and actually does the physical work of digging the hole, blasting the rock, or maintaining the equipment for the big mining houses.
Okay.
Their entire business model is built on margins, productivity, and above all, safety.
Right, because if a mining services company has a poor safety record, they simply don't win the contracts from the BHPs and the Rio Tintos of the world. Safety isn't just an HR initiative there. It is a fundamental commercial imperative.
Precisely. So when you look at Dr. Torres, her background is deeply rooted in technical operations. She understands the granular reality of deploying thousands of workers into high-risk environments globally.
Yeah, she knows how to build a safety culture that actually translates to the rock face, not just, you know, a poster in a break room.
Exactly.
Okay, I have to push back on this broader trend just a little bit, though. We are talking about boards hiring these incredibly grounded, technically rigorous operators, the chief mechanics, so to speak.
Yeah.
But we usually think of a CEO as the visionary, right? The person standing on the bow of the ship, pointing toward the horizon, and inspiring the shareholders and the press. Are boards getting scared of visionaries? Are we just going to see a generation of very boring, very efficient CEOs who only look down at the spreadsheets and never look up at the stars?
It's a fair challenge, for sure. But I would argue that in these specific industries, the definition of vision has fundamentally changed.
How so?
Well, a grand vision of a decarbonized future or a massive expansion into a new commodity is completely useless if you cannot deliver the multi-billion dollar project required to get there on time and on budget.
Ah, right.
In resources and energy, strategy is execution.
So having a vision is easy, but having the mechanical knowledge to actually build the bridge to that vision is what is rare and valuable right now.
Exactly. You mentioned the CEO standing on the bow of the ship, pointing at the horizon. The boards right now, they don't care about the pointing.
Right. They don't care where you're pointing if the ship is sinking.
Exactly. They care about whether the person knows how to calibrate the engine room, navigate the incoming storm, ensure the crew doesn't mutiny, and make sure the ship doesn't run out of fuel halfway there.
Yeah.
A candidate might have a stellar market reputation, but the board demands hard evidence. How do you make decisions when commodity prices suddenly crash? How do you navigate sudden spikes in regulatory pressure or shifting community expectations around long cycle execution?
It makes complete sense when you think about the sheer asymmetry of risk. Like if a software company pushes out a bad update, they write a patch and push it out the next morning. It's embarrassing. Maybe it costs a little money, but the company survives.
Right, exactly.
But if a mining company gets the operational details wrong, a tailings dam collapses, billions of dollars are lost, the environment is devastated, and people could literally die. You just cannot move fast and break things when you are dealing with millions of tons of iron ore.
Which is why the internal succession model is so dominant here. Brandon Craig, Liz Westcott, Vanessa Torres, they aren't taking leaps of faith. They have been tested in the crucible of their respective organizations' operational realities.
Yeah, the boards have observed their operating depth over years.
Yes.
It's a fascinating pivot. But let's take this concept of risk and operational depth and apply it to a completely different environment. Let's move from the physical dirt to the invisible dirt, which is data.
Ah, yes.
We are moving to the realm of market infrastructure and telecommunications. If mining is about physical safety and managing massive tangible assets, how does the boardroom conversation change when the core asset is public trust and digital infrastructure?
This is where the underlying mechanisms get incredibly psychological. The companies we are looking at in this space have all faced immense, highly public scrutiny. We are transitioning from the physical engine room to the digital nervous system of the country.
We have three major moves to dissect here. First, the ASX, the Australian Securities Exchange. Anthony Attia has been appointed Managing Director and CEO starting in September 2026.
Right.
But what is really interesting is that the board placed Darren Yip as the interim CEO starting all the way back in May 2026. Then we have Optus bringing in Stephen Roux as CEO under a brand new governance model.
Yep.
And finally, Virgin Australia with Dave Emerson stepping up to CEO in March 2025, taking over from Jane Hudlicka.
On the surface, an exchange, a telecommunications giant, and an airline operate in vastly different commercial realities. But when you look at the specific individuals chosen in the context of their appointments, a unified neon-lit theme emerges.
Which is?
Trust repair and the desperate need for continuity.
Okay, let's break that down, starting with the ASX. For you listening, if you aren't familiar with the inner workings of the stock market, the text highlights the CSS replacement backdrop.
Ah, yes.
CS is the Clearinghouse Electronic Subregister System. It is essentially the absolute digital plumbing of the Australian economy. Like, when you click buy on your brokerage app to purchase shares in a company, CS is the invisible system that actually settles that trade, transfers the legal ownership, and moves the money.
It is a piece of critical national infrastructure that operates almost entirely in the background. Until it breaks, or in this case, until the attempt to upgrade it, turns into a highly publicized multi-year failure.
Right. The ASX tried to replace this aging 1990s technology with a modern blockchain-based system, and it was, frankly, a catastrophic project failure.
Yeah, absolutely catastrophic.
It cost hundreds of millions of dollars, frustrated the entire financial sector, and deeply damaged the ASX's reputation for technical competence.
And that failure completely rewrote the job description for the incoming CEO. Market infrastructure leadership no longer just requires deep capital markets experience or an understanding of equities trading.
Yeah, that's not enough anymore.
Exactly. The board recognized that the new CEO essentially has to be a chief risk officer and a chief technology officer rolled into one highly scrutinized public-facing role. The priority shifted entirely to deep technology delivery and flawless risk control.
But the truly fascinating part of the ASX story isn't just who they hired for the long term, it's how they staged the transition. As we mentioned, they brought in Darren Yip as interim CEO for a significant period before Anthony Attia takes the reins.
Yes.
Why not just rip the Band-Aid off and put the new guy in the seat immediately?
Because the asset they are managing isn't just a trading platform, it is market confidence. When trust is fractured, sudden movements cause panic.
I see.
Using Darren Yip as an interim CEO is a masterclass in psychological management of a market. The board is intentionally creating a buffer.
Like a shock absorber.
Precisely. They are signaling to regulators, brokers, and listed companies, look, We understand the severity of the technology issues. We have a steady known hand on the wheel to ensure absolute continuity right now, while we carefully prepare the runway for the long-term strategic leader.
It is entirely about projecting stability. They are removing any sense of chaos from the transition, and we see a different flavor of this stabilization strategy over at Optus.
We certainly do.
Optus had a brutal period. Massive network outages, severe data breaches, a real crisis of brand confidence. And when a company's reputation is absolutely on fire, the traditional instinct is often to hire the loudest, most charismatic savior you can find.
Exactly. The playbook usually calls for a showman.
Right. You want someone to go on a massive apology tour, do the morning television rounds, look sincerely into the camera, and loudly declare that a new day has dawned and everything is going to fundamentally change.
Yeah, but it seems like the Optus board deliberately chose the exact opposite path by appointing Stephen Roux.
They really did.
I would argue that hiring a loud savior in a trust-sensitive environment is actually the most dangerous thing a board can do. Think about the psychology of the consumer or the regulator in that moment. They feel betrayed by broken promises or system failures.
They don't want to hear another speech.
Exactly. The absolute last thing they want is another highly polished executive making grand, sweeping promises about a utopian future.
They don't want a showman. They want a mechanic who works quietly and actually fixes the pipes.
Precisely. In a trust repair scenario, the best candidate is rarely the loudest transformation storyteller. The board is looking for an executive who can stabilize the complex underlying infrastructure, communicate plainly without corporate jargon, keep a massive workforce aligned,
and actually deliver.
Right. And this is the absolute golden rule: make visible, empirical progress without ever overpromising.
Visible progress without overpromising. That is incredibly hard to do when the media is demanding sweeping changes. And Optus didn't just change the CEO, they changed the structure around him. The appointment came under a new governance model with more direct board reporting.
Which is the structural enforcement of that plain communication. The board is essentially shortening the leash. They're saying, look, we cannot afford any surprises. Rebuilding trust happens through flawless infrastructure execution and tight oversight, not through marketing campaigns.
And then we look at Virgin Australia and Dave Emerson. He succeeded Jane Herdlicka in March 2025. Now, Jane Herdlicka led Virgin through an unbelievably tumultuous period. Administration, a private equity buyout, navigating a global pandemic, and a massive structural reset of the airline.
She was the wartime transformation CEO.
Yeah, that's exactly what she was.
And Dave Emerson is described perfectly as the transformation insider. This highlights a concept we rarely talk about, which is transformation fatigue.
Oh, that's a great term.
An organization can only endure massive, sweeping changes for so long before the culture fractures and the basic operations start to suffer. Virgin Australia went through its revolution. The board recognized that the mandate now wasn't to start another massive overhaul.
The mandate is to actually run the airline they just spent years rebuilding.
Yes. It is about continuity. It's about executing on the commercial, shareholder, and customer strategies that have painstakingly been put in place. By elevating an insider like Emerson, the board signals to the thousands of pilots, baggage handlers, and corporate staff, as well as the market, that the exhausting period of existential transformation is over.
So the focus now is just evolution and relentless execution.
Exactly.
So whether it's the ASX staging a transition to calm the financial markets, Optus structurally tightening governance to ensure quiet, reliable execution, or Virgin choosing an insider to heal transformation fatigue, the underlying mechanism is identical.
Yeah, you rebuild or protect confidence by keeping the business moving steadily.
No sudden jarring jerks to the steering wheel. It requires a leader with a profound amount of operational restraint.
Operational restraint is a fantastic term for it, and that perfectly bridges us to our next environment, because if you want to see what operational restraint looks like on a daily microscopic level, you have to look at the consumer market.
Let's move into the relentless rhythm of the global consumer franchise engine. We've just looked at repairing broken trust during a crisis, but how do leaders maintain trust every single day, hour by hour, with millions of individual consumers buying a relatively low-cost item?
This brings us to the concept of operating cadence. And there is no better crucible for operating cadence than a massive quick-service restaurant chain. The prime example here is Domino's Pizza Enterprises, with the appointment of Andrew Gregory as the incoming group CEO and managing director, set to take over no later than August 2026.
Now, when people think about running a giant pizza empire, they probably imagine a visionary chef in a test kitchen coming up with a crazy new stuffed crust or, you know, a brilliant marketer designing a Super Bowl commercial.
Oh, completely.
But that is completely missing the reality of the business model.
It completely misses it. Running a global franchise model of that scale is not a culinary job, and it's not a branding job.
Right.
It is fundamentally a systems job.
Right.
The mandate for Andrew Gregory focuses explicitly on franchise economics, global QSR discipline, and a customer value reset.
Okay, let's unpack this systems job concept, because it is vital. A company like Domino's is essentially a sprawling network of microeconomies. Let's walk through a hypothetical Friday night dinner rush to understand this system for you listening.
Sure.
You have the consumer, you have the corporate headquarters, and you have the individual franchisee who actually owns the local store.
The famous franchise triangle.
Yeah.
And keeping that triangle balanced is the definition of operating cadence.
Right. So let's say the corporate headquarters decides they want to drive massive top-line revenue growth, so they launch a highly publicized digital campaign, say any large pizza for $5.
Okay. Sounds good for the customer.
From a marketing perspective, it's a brilliant vision. Customers flood the app. The app promises a pizza in 20 minutes.
But what happens to the system?
Exactly. The system fractures. First, if the corporate supply chain hasn't flawlessly predicted this demand and delivered the exact right amount of flour, cheese, and pepperoni to every single store, the local franchise runs out of ingredients.
Which is a disaster.
The 20-minute promise is broken. The customer is furious.
And the financial strain is even worse.
Right. If the cost of the ingredients plus the labor to make the pizza is $4.50, that $5 promotional price has completely squeezed the franchisee's profit margin.
They are essentially working for free at that point.
The franchisee is now losing money on every order during their busiest night. To survive, they might cut corners. Like, they understaff the store, they rush the cooking process, the quality drops, the customer gets a bad pizza late and decides never to order again. The corporate marketing vision just destroyed the actual business at the ground level.
That hypothetical perfectly illustrates the interlocking complexity. Franchise economics, pricing strategies, store operations, supply chain logistics, customer value perception, and digital app execution, all of those elements have to move to the exact same beat.
Because if one gear slips, the whole machine grinds to a halt.
Exactly. So when the board of Domino's is sitting in a room interviewing potential CEOs, what are they actually testing for? Because a slick presentation on synergy isn't going to fix a margin squeeze in a store in suburban Sydney.
No, it definitely won't.
They are testing for empirical evidence of the ability to run that repeatable, flawless operating cadence. They do not care about abstract management theories. The interview process for these roles is brutally specific.
What are they asking?
They want to know, what specific operating metric did you actually change in your last role, and how did you change it?
Show me the math.
Yes, show me the math and show me the mechanics. But there is an even more powerful question boards ask in this environment. It is the ultimate test of operational discipline. They ask, what did you stop doing?
Oh, that is such an insightful question. Because when a new executive comes into a role, human nature and ego dictate that they want to make their mark.
Of course they do.
They want to launch new initiatives, add new layers of reporting, introduce a shiny new product line. It's incredibly easy to add complexity.
It is the easiest thing in the world to start a new project. But adding complexity to an already strained system is fatal.
It takes immense commercial courage to look at a sprawling, beloved organization and say, look, we are stopping this legacy product line. We are killing this marketing initiative. We are shutting down this software project because it is dragging down the overall operating cadence.
It requires an executive who can absorb extreme, conflicting pressure from every direction. The customers are constantly demanding lower prices and faster delivery.
And the franchisees are screaming for higher profit margins and lower corporate fees.
Right. And the institutional investors are demanding aggressive quarter-over-quarter growth, and the internal corporate teams are complaining about burnout. The CEO's job is to somehow take all of that intense, conflicting friction and convert it into a smooth, repeatable commercial rhythm.
Wow.
They want to see the proof. How did you maintain absolute customer loyalty while simultaneously improving the profit margin?
It sounds almost impossible when you lay it out like that. You are constantly tightening the screws while making sure nobody notices the pressure. It really drives home why the visionary chef is the wrong profile. You need the ultimate supply chain and systems ninja.
And managing those margins brings us to a critical inflection point in our analysis. Because whether you are trying to execute a multi-billion dollar shift in a physical mining operation, or trying to rebuild technological trust in a market exchange, or trying to manage the complex margins of a global pizza franchise, none of it happens without one foundational resource.
Capital. You cannot move dirt, you cannot write code, and you cannot make pizza without capital.
Which leads us to what might be the most dramatic and consequential evolution in the entire C-suite right now. Let's explore the strategic CFO and the reality of finance as the co-pilot.
If our previous discussions were about the hands on the steering wheel, this is entirely about the engine management system.
Oh, I like that.
The data shows a rapid-fire series of appointments that definitively prove the chief financial officer is no longer just the chief accountant sitting in a back office churning out historical spreadsheets.
The role has completely exploded in scope. Let's run through the key appointments that highlight this shift. We have Orizon, where Ian Wells was appointed CFO and Group Executive Strategy.
Huge move.
Then we have AMP undergoing a complete executive reset, moving Blair Vernon up to Group CEO and bringing in Jackie Cleary as the new CFO. We have Aurora appointing Paul Victor as CFO right after a massive corporate transaction period involving Saverglass and the sale of their packaging solutions division.
We have ResMed bringing in Aaron Bloomer as CFO to drive global healthcare scale. And even in the banking context, we see ANZ bringing in Nuno Matos as CEO, specifically to simplify a complex financial story and bring international retail scale.
I want to start with Orizon because that job title, CFO and Group Executive Strategy, is the loudest, most undeniable signal in the entire data set.
Really? Why is that so significant?
Historically, strategy and finance were often completely separate functions. Strategy came up with the grand ideas and finance figured out how to pay for them or acted as the department of no when the ideas were too expensive.
Right. Strategy painted the map and finance was just the toll booth.
Exactly. But combining them fundamentally changes the power dynamic.
It explicitly places finance leadership at the very genesis of strategic choices.
Yes. The person holding the purse strings isn't just reacting to the map, they are drawing it. They are in charge of portfolio optimization, deciding which divisions live and die. They are in charge of capital allocation, deciding where the next $100 million goes to generate the highest return.
They are funding the future, not just reporting on the past.
And we see this deeply strategic, capital-focused approach playing out dramatically at AMP. The board there paired a former CFO, Blair Vernon, who was elevated to CEO, with a highly capable new strategic CFO in Jackie Cleary.
I see that pairing as a masterstroke of intentional design by the AMP board. They are publicly declaring that balance sheet optimization and shareholder outcomes are the sole focus of this era for the company.
Let's do a quick explain. Like, I'm five on balance sheet optimization for the listeners who might glaze over when they hear financial jargon. What does that actually mean in practice?
Yeah, please.
In simple terms, a company's balance sheet is a list of what it owns, its assets, and what it owes its liabilities. Optimizing it means constantly manipulating those two columns to make the company stronger and more nimble.
Okay, can you give an example?
Sure. It might mean aggressively paying down high-interest debt so you have more free cash flow every month. It might mean selling off a real estate asset that isn't generating enough return and using that cash to buy back your own company's shares.
Which instantly makes the remaining shares more valuable to the investors.
Exactly. It is the highly technical art of making the company's money work harder.
Okay, here's where this gets really interesting, and I want to push on this dynamic.
Go for it.
If the modern CFO is now designing the strategy, handling the massive institutional investors, optimizing the portfolio, and driving the actual commercial transformation, What exactly is the CEO left to do? Are we basically seeing a co-CEO situation operating in disguise? Because it sounds like the CFO is running the show.
It is a phenomenal question, and it speaks to a real tension in modern boardrooms. It is absolutely a partnership, but I wouldn't call it a co-CEO situation. The dynamic has shifted from a boss and subordinate relationship to a true pilot and co-pilot model.
Okay, so the CEO is the pilot.
Yes. The CEO is still ultimately accountable for the destination. They are managing the broader stakeholder ecosystem, defining the corporate culture, and taking the ultimate public heat.
But the CFO is sitting right next to them, ensuring the plane actually has the structural integrity and the fuel calculations to make the trip.
Exactly. And the market is demanding a very specific trait from these new CFOs. The data highlights a phrase that I think perfectly encapsulates this new era commercial courage with the CEO.
Commercial courage. I love the weight of that phrase.
It means the CFO cannot just be a passive accountant. A technically sound CFO who knows the tax code inside out, but who cannot sit in a room with a highly charismatic, aggressive CEO and say, no, your vision for this acquisition is structurally flawed, and here is the data proving it will destroy shareholder value, is completely underpowered in today's market.
Yeah, if you can only say no, but can't mathematically explain how to find a better path, you aren't strategic.
But the reverse is also true, right?
Absolutely. The market is equally ruthless toward the big picture CFO. A highly strategic, visionary CFO who is great at talking to investment bankers, but who cannot run a reliable month-end financial close, who cannot accurately forecast cash flow, or who lets basic corporate governance slip, is worse than useless.
If they are dangerous.
You must have absolute data and systems fluency. You have to be able to explain complex financial risk to the board without slowing the actual business down unnecessarily.
And you see why this is so critical in scenarios like Aurora with Paul Victor. They just executed massive transactions, buying Saverglass, selling a packaging division. When you do M&A on that scale, the press release is the easy part. The CEO gets to ring the bell.
Right.
But the CFO is the one who inherits two different accounting systems, two different corporate cultures, complex debt structures, and has to somehow make the actual math match the promises made in the press release.
Integration and transformation experience is central to the modern CFO brief. And in a global growth company like ResMed, bringing in Aaron Bloomer shows that rigorous finance discipline is viewed as the primary engine for global healthcare scale.
They don't view finance as a handbrake on growth.
No, they view it as the mechanism that makes scale possible without the company tearing itself apart.
Even looking at the banking side, with Nuno Matos coming into ANZ, banking is an incredibly complex, highly regulated environment. The board needs a leader who can take that massive tangled web of international retail scale and simplify the narrative.
They need someone who can sit down with regulators, hostile politicians, institutional investors, and retail customers, and explain the financial reality with absolute clarity and discipline.
It all ties back to capital control.
So we have traversed a massive amount of corporate terrain here. We've analyzed the deep operational roots required in mining, the psychological trust building required in digital infrastructure, the relentless systems mastery needed in consumer franchises, and the strategic evolution of the capital co-pilot in the CFO suite.
It is a fundamentally altered landscape.
It really is. So how do we make this actionable? Let's move to our final area of focus, which is the playbook for boards and candidates. If you are listening to this right now, whether you are a board member about to design a search for your next CEO, an HR leader trying to vet top-tier candidates, or an ambitious executive trying to position yourself for one of these roles, the rules of engagement have changed. Pay close attention.
Let's start with the boards. The days of launching a generic search for a strong, visionary leader are over. Boards are becoming surgically specific about the exact problem they are hiring to solve.
They are no longer hiring a generalist. They are hiring a highly specific tool for a highly specific job.
Right. Are you hiring to ensure continuity? Do you need a total structural reset? Are you trying to survive a regulatory crackdown? Do you need to repair a fractured relationship with a franchisee network?
Those are entirely different missions requiring entirely different psychological and professional profiles.
Exactly. You wouldn't use a hammer to fix a delicate watch, and you wouldn't use a scalpel to break a rock.
Well said. And to prevent a search committee from drifting off course and simply getting seduced by a charismatic candidate with a famous name, boards must enforce rigorous discipline. There are five critical questions a board must answer definitively before they even engage a search firm.
Let's run through this diagnostic. Question one, what is the specific business risk this appointment must reduce?
This immediately flips the traditional narrative. You aren't hiring to gain some abstract sunny upside. You are hiring to mitigate a tangible threat.
Yeah, if you are a pizza franchise, the risk might be margin compression destroying your store network. If you are a telco, the risk is regulatory intervention due to system outages. Define the monster in the room first.
Question two, What concrete evidence would prove a candidate can actually handle that specific risk?
This moves the conversation away from gut feelings and culture fit. It demands empirical proof. If the defined risk is a massive cybersecurity overhaul of legacy systems, a candidate simply giving a good answer about tech strategy isn't evidence.
No, the evidence is a verified track record of implementing complex digital plumbing without bringing down the customer experience in a live environment.
Exactly. Question 3. Which stakeholders must trust this appointment from day one?
This changes depending on the crisis, right? If you are the ASX, the primary audience for the hire is the financial regulator and the clearinghouses. You need someone who speaks their language of risk.
And if you are Domino's, the primary audience is the angry franchise network. You need someone who speaks the language of store-level margins.
Question 4. What parts of the existing executive team need to be strengthened around this new hire?
Because no leader, no matter how talented, operates in a vacuum. If a board decides they absolutely must hire a highly visionary, outward-facing CEO to handle market sentiment, they must simultaneously realize that they need to surround that CEO with incredibly disciplined, technically rigorous operators.
Perhaps a highly strategic CFO like we saw at AMP. You build the team to offset the blind spots of the leader.
Exactly. And finally, question 5, what trade-offs are acceptable and which are absolutely not?
Because the perfect candidate does not exist.
Never. A board has to make mature compromises. Are you willing to accept a candidate with slightly less direct industry experience if they possess world-class turnaround and cost-cutting skills?
If the search committee doesn't define these acceptable trade-offs before the interview start, they will end up arguing in circles and likely settling for a safe, mediocre compromise.
Okay, so that is the rigorous homework required of the board. But what about the executives themselves? If I am a senior candidate sitting in that high-stakes interview, the old tricks just won't work anymore.
No, they won't. Let's be honest. Most executive CVs are just a collection of generic corporate buzzwords. Led digital transformation. Managed key external stakeholders. Built high-performing, agile teams.
Yeah, if you walk into an interview with that script, how do you actually prove you're the real deal in this new environment?
If you rely on generic buzzwords, you will be systematically dismantled in the interview. You have to translate your past experience directly into this specific operating language and risk profile of the company you are interviewing for. You must remember, the board is not buying your CV. They are buying a likely outcome.
They are buying the solution to their specific nightmare. So how do they test for that outcome?
They test for it through relentless, highly specific questioning. A candidate must be prepared to answer things like, detail exactly how you allocated capital when internal priorities fiercely competed.
Right. Don't just tell me you managed a large budget. Tell me about the Tuesday afternoon when you had to look your favorite product manager in the eye and defund their beloved project because the core business needed that cash to survive. Tell me about the conflict.
Exactly. They will ask, how did you specifically deal with structurally underperforming teams or toxic legacy assets? Did you reorganize them, or did you have the operational courage to cut them entirely?
How did you communicate with hostile boards, nervous lenders, or angry regulators when the numbers were bad? Did you hide behind PR spin, or did you provide plain, unvarnished facts?
In tying back to the systems job, they will want granular detail on how you actually improved operating cadence. What exact levers did you pull? Did you renegotiate a supplier contract? Did you change the incentive structure for middle management?
And I think the most revealing question of all is about failure. What did you learn from a difficult handover, a failed product launch, or a transformation effort that went completely off the rails?
Transparency about failure is the ultimate proof of operational maturity. Now, this doesn't mean external candidates are dead. The data shows executives like Nuno Matos at ANZ or Stephen Rue at Optus are still highly sought after.
But their success hinges entirely on their ability to act as a Rosetta Stone, right?
Yes. Translating their proven, hard-won experience from one sector into the specific operating mechanics of their new environment.
So as we pull back and look at this massive tapestry of executive movement across 2025 and 2026, let's do a quick recap of the journey we've been on.
We started in the physical dirt with mining and resources, where the celebrity visionary is dead, replaced by the chief mechanic who understands the granular realities of capital intensity and operational friction.
Then we transitioned into the digital realm of market infrastructure and telecommunications, where the absolute mandate is trust repair. Boards in this space are actively rejecting loud showmen in favor of quiet stabilizers who ensure absolute continuity and visible progress without overpromising.
From there, we looked at the relentless consumer franchise models, where leadership is fundamentally a highly delicate systems job focused on operating cadence and the commercial courage to know what to stop doing.
And tying it all together, we examined the dramatic elevation of the CFO from back office accountant to strategic co-pilot, driving capital allocation, portfolio optimization, and wielding immense commercial courage to keep the CEO grounded in financial reality.
It is a breathtakingly different landscape than it was even 5 years ago. But before we sign off, I know you always like to look past the data and leave us with something provocative to chew on. Based on everything we've unpacked today, what is the final thought you want to leave lingering with the listener?
Well, if we step back and look at the aggregate of all these perfectly logical, highly specific hiring decisions, a lingering tension starts to emerge, a potential blind spot.
Interesting.
Throughout this entire analysis, we've seen that boards are currently hyper-focused, almost obsessively so, on hiring executives who are perfectly surgically tailored to solve today's specific crises.
Right. The ASX has a tech failure, so they hire a tech risk expert. Optus has a trust issue, so they hire a steady governance expert. Domino's has margin pressure, so they hire a supply chain ninja. They're defining the exact present-day risk and hiring the exact human tool to mitigate it. It makes perfect sense.
It makes perfect sense for today. But here's the provocative question I want the listener to ponder. If you systematically build an executive team entirely out of hyper-specialists hired specifically to solve a present-day problem, what happens to that company when tomorrow brings an entirely different, completely unpredictable crisis?
Oh, that's a brilliant point.
By moving so aggressively away from adaptable, generalist leaders and hyper-optimizing for today's specific pain points, do these boards risk creating brittle leadership teams? Have they traded long-term strategic flexibility for short-term operational stability?
Because when a completely unforeseen macroeconomic shock hits in, say, 2028, will the chief mechanic know how to redesign the entire vehicle or only how to fix the engine they were hired to maintain?
Have they traded long-term flexibility for short-term stability? That is the question.
That is an incredible question to end on. Because as we said at the very beginning of this deep dive, the game of musical chairs has completely changed. You don't just need a seat anymore. You need to know how the chair is built.
Exactly.
But the ultimate danger is spending all of your time, energy, and capital perfectly engineering a chair for today's song, only to realize the band just started playing a completely different tune and you're stuck sitting in the wrong piece of furniture.
That is the ultimate executive challenge of the next decade.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We highly encourage you to take this new analytical framework and look closer at the leadership moves happening right now in your own industries. Who is getting the corner office? And more importantly, what exact nightmare is the board terrified of right now that they hired that specific person to solve? Keep asking the hard questions, keep looking for the underlying mechanisms, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.